Hey, I'm Eric Torenberg, and welcome to another episode of Maker Stories, where we explore what makes the makers, what drives them, what they're scared of, how they make sense of the world, and everything in between. This week's episode is with Adam Grant. Adam is the youngest professor ever to be tenured at Wharton Business School, and a best-selling author of Give and Take, and most recently, Originals. We talk about what separates originals from their peers, what environments best nurture original thinking, how people can become more creative, why the effects of parenting, in his opinion, are overrated, and much, much more. This is a fascinating conversation, and Originals is a great book. Definitely check it out. Okay, here's Adam. Adam, I know we've been wanting to do this for a while. I'm so excited. Thank you for joining us in Products on Live today.
Thanks for having me. Thrilled to be here.
Yeah, so we have so much we want to get into from in terms of your book Originals, your password Give and Take, just your work in general. But first, just want to start off, give us the origin story of Originals. Why this book? Why now? How did it
come? There's so many answers to that, Eric. I hardly know where to start. So I'll pick one origin story, which is I was a senior in high school and I was going halfway across the country for college. I was a little bit afraid that I was going to have no friends when I went there. So I was on AOL at the time and I started searching profiles to see if there was anyone who went to the same or was going to the same school as me. And I found about 15, 20 people. We started an email list and then everybody began adding people that they knew. And by April, this started in December, I think. In April, there were over 200 of us. And we ended up meeting up at a pre-freshman weekend. And we arrived at Harvard that fall, and there was a little news article about how we had started the first online social network. But none of us ever took any action on it. And a few years later, some guy named Mark started Facebook in the dorm next door. So I was curious about, why none of us took the initiative, why we were all afraid to take the leap to turn this into something bigger than just a little email group, and how we can all close the gap between the new ideas we have and then bringing them out into the world.
In high school, in college, what did you think you were going to do?
I had no idea. I was still harboring dreams of making the NBA. But at 4'9", as a high school freshman, that probably wasn't in the cards for me. No, I really had no clue what I wanted to do with my career. I knew I wanted to do something where I could pursue things that were intrinsically interesting and that were useful to other people, but I did not know where to begin.
What is the book's reception? What has surprised you, if anything?
I think, there have been a lot of surprises to me. It's always a pleasant surprise when people read the things that you write. So that was the first surprise. And then, after we started getting reader feedback, I think the thing that's been most surprising to me is how many people are sitting around with ideas and thinking, if I don't quit my day job, then I'm never going to be able to turn this into anything. And, I found it surprising too, this evidence that entrepreneurs who keep their day jobs are 33% less likely to fail than the ones who quit and go all in. But I underestimated the number of people who were sitting there thinking, I have to choose between my job and, sort of take in this leap. And I've been really excited, actually, to hear from a lot of people who have said, I've realized after reading the book that I can do both.
So let's go back to that story for a second. You had this idea for a social network. You guys didn't pursue it. The sort of idea of groupthink or pressure to break the mold. How do we fight groupthink in a era of where social media is sort of reaffirming what we believe every day, and it's tougher to even break that?
I think the place to start actually is to read people who you disagree with. I think unfortunately a lot of us are living in what Eli Pariser has called a filter bubble, where every single place that you go for news and information is carefully curated either by you or by smart technologies that mimic you. And over time, you get exposure over and over to the things that are more and more aligned with what you already believe. And pretty soon, you're in an echo chamber of one. I think you want to find people who you believe are thoughtful, intelligent, insightful, but contrary to a lot of your core values and your worldview. And you want to engage with their ideas because you're much more likely to learn something new from somebody who disagrees with you than somebody who shares your perspective.
Strongly disagree with that you find yourself reading over and over again.
Oh, there are so many. In what realm?
Let's say economics or politics.
Economics or politics? David Brooks is a great example. I think, you know, I find myself disagreeing with the majority of the views that he expresses, but he brings his ideas out in a way that makes me think and leads me to question a lot of the assumptions I make about the world. And I think that's good for me, even if I don't enjoy every moment of it.
I think that's a testament to him, maybe as a writer and a thinker, that a lot of people disagree with him, but still read him consistently.
Yeah, I think, I mean, to me, that's a greater mark of success than having a bunch of people say, I agree with you, right? That you're actually able to get the ear and the eyes of people who think you're wrong. That's pretty compelling.
What do academics know about originality that sort of business practitioners often forget or don't know, and vice versa?
Well, I think in general, most of what I've seen in business is a decade or more ahead of what we know in academia, right? So as social scientists, we're often out looking for interesting things that have been discovered out in the world and then trying to go and study them and understand them better. But there are some areas where I would say social scientists are sometimes ahead of the curve. One of them is just what it takes to be original in the first place. I think frequently in business, you get rewarded for being a little bit of an imitation, not a perfect copy. But you know, if you're too different from something that already exists, people have a very hard time appreciating it and understanding it. And I think in social science, the opposite is true. It's almost impossible to publish your work if you're not challenging conventional wisdom, because people will say, we already know that. Why do we need another replication out there? Tell me how this idea goes against the grain in some way. And I think that, you know, my favorite take on this is Murray Davis. He wrote this amazing article more than four decades ago called That's Interesting. And it's this crazy idea that the things that we find to be worth knowing, we don't remember them because they're true. We remember them because they're interesting. And a lot of people find that objectionable, right? That interest is more influential than truth. But Davis then says, well, if you buy that assumption, what makes something interesting? And he says, to be interesting, you have to surprise. You have to disagree with what people already assume to be true. Otherwise, they're just going to say, ah, I already knew that. Who cares? And then he goes and unpacks all these different ways to challenge conventional wisdom. You could say something that you thought was bad is actually good, or vice versa. You could say, you know, something that you thought was homogeneous is actually heterogeneous. And he has this whole index of the interesting, and then says, if you follow this, you will cease to be interesting, right? So you can't use this as a formula. And then he adds this little disclaimer that, yes, interesting ideas are the ones that challenge conventional wisdom, but only if those beliefs are weakly held. If you challenge people's strongly held assumptions, then you're just going to make them angry and they're not going to listen to you or engage with you. And so he argues that there's this sweet spot, right? You have to find things that people sort of tentatively believe are true and then show that they're false. But they can't be too fervently attached to those ideas. Otherwise, you know, you don't get through to them. And I would love to see more entrepreneurs, more creative people understand that there's, you know, this, you can be too different, you can be too similar, and Goldilocks is ultimately the way to capture attention.
Let's talk about some of the examples in the book. One of them is, you know, mutual friend Meredith Perry, who went to Penn and is the founder of UBeam. Tell a little bit about why, you know, she's such an original to you and what you think we can learn from her story.
Well, I love the fact that Meredith was a college senior in 2011, sitting around realizing that all of her devices were wireless except the power source. Right? She's like, I can get internet through the air. Why can't I charge my phone or my laptop that way? Why am I tethered to a desk? This is terrible. And a lot of us have those complaints, and you know, we kind of harass our roommates with them, and then we move on to something else. But Meredith actually sat down and said, I'm going to do something about this. She's not an engineer. She's not a physicist. So, you know, even knowing where to start is not an easy thing. But she ends up doing enough research that she figures out you can convert vibrations in the air into energy. So if you were to stand near a moving train, for example, that would generate some degree of power. And if you knew how to harness it, you could use that to charge your devices. She decides she's going to start this company, UBeam. And because she's not an engineer, she needs to hire a team to build a prototype. But when she goes to potential engineers, they all say, this is insane. You can't harness enough energy. The radiation will be too high. It's physically impossible. She has Nobel Prize winners telling her to go home. And I think a lot of us would have quit there. Actually, just about anyone I know would have quit there. But Meredith had the courage to persist with her idea. And I think that, you know, that makes her hugely original, that she was willing to keep going when lots of people who were more knowledgeable and more expert than her said, you have to stick with, or you have to walk away, she stuck with it. And I think what she ended up doing was ingenious, which is she had been going to engineers and saying, you know, I want to build wireless power. Can you make me this transducer? And they would say, no, you're crazy. And she changed her pitch and just started saying, you know, I'm wondering if you could build me a transducer with these parts, with these properties. She never mentioned wireless power. And then she got a very different reaction. Engineers would say, well, I've never thought to do it quite that way before, but let me give it a shot. She was able to get them on board. She built the prototype. I think they're pretty close at this point to doing what everyone thought was impossible. And the lesson I took away from that is that sometimes you have to take your real vision and smuggle it in a Trojan horse. And that, you know, giving people the ultimate goal that you're trying to achieve, if it's pretty radical and original, might alienate them.
You almost have to back into it via first principles.
Yes, which worked beautifully in her case. And I think we see this in a lot of cases, right? This is why Elon Musk did not start SpaceX and immediately say, I want to go to Mars. Who's with me? Right? He said, I want to take a private commercial vehicle into orbit and back. And then once he shows that's possible, people are a lot more willing to entertain some of his more outlandish suggestions.
Lots of, let's just say there are lots of Elons or lots of Merediths. And Meredith's a good example because she's fairly young still. Lots of potential Merediths out there. What separates, you know, the Merediths from the Merediths that become Meredith from the Merediths that never become Meredith, you know, in their environment?
I think there are a lot of things that separate them. And most of us assume that, you know, it's hardwired, that, you know, you have to have this biological immunity to fear. You have to be willing to take crazy risks. And the data just don't support that. It turns out that the most original people in the world hate risk-taking. They're much more cautious than their peers. They feel the same doubt and fear that the rest of us do. They just manage it differently. They harness it as a resource. And we can talk a little bit more about that. And they also have tons and tons of ideas. So, you know, it's always interesting when people will come to you and say, you know, I have this idea, but I don't want to tell anyone about it because I'm afraid that it's going to get stolen. I have never met a successful person who did something original in the world who had only one idea. And one of the best predictors of whether you go on to do something truly new, whether you're going to drive creativity and change in the world, is just the sheer volume of output that you come up with, because you need variety to get to originality. And the best way to have variety is volume. So I think that, you know, one of the things that distinguishes Meredith is she had tons of ideas, right? This was, UBeam was only one of them. And she was pursuing a number of them in parallel to figure out which ones were different and better than what existed before. And then she finally made a bet on one that seemed to have real potential.
You know, you're a professor at you're a top professor at a top university. Have you seen experiments, whether at Penn or elsewhere, that are, you know, that are really exciting you in this way, or is there something you can do to?
Well, I think that we need to give people a chance to, one, have the seeds planted for new ideas, and then two, give them a forum to express them. So I'll tell you what I've been trying to do in my own classroom, just as a small step in this direction. When I started writing originals, I had this great moment of hypocrisy where I realized that I wasn't following any of my own advice. And I'm talking about how we need to challenge people to, you know, be nonconformists and, you know, really break from convention and tradition. And then I'm teaching this whole class on evidence-based management, where students are expected to internalize all the data that already exists and then, you know, kind of just regurgitate it, right? So I created two different ways to try to encourage students to express their original ideas. One was about two-thirds of the way through the semester, I had them pair up to work together and create a mini TED Talk. And the idea was that they had to champion something that they thought was true but was counterintuitive, and then marshal a case that they might be right. And they could pick any idea they wanted. You know, for my class, it was in the realm of work or human behavior or psychology. And then their job was to make a pitch for it and innovate not just in the content, but also the delivery. And I was just blown away by the creativity that students brought to the table. And I realized I wasn't doing a good job giving them a chance to express it. And then the second thing I ended up doing was I spent a day of class last fall inviting students to pitch their ideas for how we would use a class session later that semester. And everyone got together in groups. They came up with ideas. And then I sort of caught them by surprise by telling them that the person who was most quiet in their group was the one who was responsible for pitching the idea. So we would diversify the voices in the classroom a little bit. And one of the best ideas that came out was from the senior, Lauren McCann, who said, you know, what I would love to do is I would love to have seniors write letters to freshmen about what they wish they had known a few years earlier. And I thought this was brilliant, and I encouraged her to do it. And just a couple weeks ago, she launched this website called DearPenFreshman.com. They got over 10,000 hits in the first day. And now other universities around the world are actually starting to adopt it. And it was just such a small thing, right, to say in class, who has an idea? And then, you know, give her a tiny bit of a nudge to say, go and do this. It was all it took. And I think I could be doing a lot more of that. So could the rest of us.
As an educator, you know, do you think that, and this is an earnest question here, I don't know the answer, do you think that you know, it should be slightly modified, or do you think that it should, you know, sort of blow up and start over? I mean, what do you think?
Two thoughts on K-12. First one is, I'm a huge fan of the George Lucas proposal that instead of just having grades and test scores and maybe some essays as part of the application to college, we should have a creative portfolio that every student submits as part of their application. And, you know, you worry a little bit about gaming the system, right? Where that parents are now not only teaching their kids math and trying to write their essays, but they will then make movies for their kids and compose songs for them. But I think knowing, you know, if you know in seventh or eighth grade that one of the things you're going to end high school with is a sample of something original that you've done, whether it's, you know, art or a story that you wrote or, you know, anything that you want to create, a business, a website, I think that would encourage a lot of parents to stop being tiger moms and Lombardi dads and, you know, to actually think about helping kids do something that reflects them. The other thing that I would say is we're facing this big debate right now between, you know, how much learning should be lecture driven, instructor led versus, you know, sort of self-directed, giving students a chance to explore on their own. And I think actually neither approach is the right answer. I think what we should be doing more of is peer-to-peer learning. We've known for decades that the best way to learn something is to teach it. And if we did a better job organizing students into small groups where they were responsible for learning different things and then sharing their insights with their peers, I think that would be the best possible way to give them a chance to internalize what they themselves had to share.
What, and you talk about this in the book a bit, what's the role of parents in you know, fostering, you know,
Well, I think actually parents are mostly overrated. This is deeply disturbing to most parents, and I think it's part of why we need to hear the message even more. You know, I say that for a few reasons. One, you know, there's a lot of behavioral genetic evidence suggesting that most of the influence that parents have on their kids is through the genes they pass on, not through the way that they actually raise them. And two, if you track what parents who raise highly creative children actually do differently from other parents, you see that it's a lot easier to thwart originality than it is to nurture it. So, you know, parents who are physically or emotionally abusive, you know, obviously not good for your kids. And, you know, creating too many rules, forcing too much rote practice also doesn't help with originality. But it's less clear what exactly you need to do in order to foster it. There is evidence that parents who focus on values rather than rules end up setting their kids up to do original things, because then when their kids confront ideas that, you know, might be unpopular, their kids will say, look, these are my principles and this is who I am and this is what I stand for. And I'm not going to worry that much about whether other people think this idea makes sense or not, because I was raised to believe in a set of values that are important to me. But I think parents should actually chill out quite a bit on this and just say, look, as long as I don't screw up my kids, I'm doing pretty well.
Yeah. Are you a parent yourself?
I am. Yeah. 3 kids, 7, 5, and 2.
Wow. And do you find yourself taking that advice?
Most of the time I try to. You know, there are moments where I will hear myself saying things that are directly at odds with what I've written about. So, you know, I have this whole section in chapter 6 of Originals about teaching values, not rules. And literally yesterday we're at the dinner table and I hear myself saying, all right, new rule. And then, you know, I make some stupid rule and then I don't even bother to enforce it, which is like a lose-lose.
Right.
And I think that, you know, most of the time I recognize these mistakes in hindsight rather than, you know, in anticipation. Mm-hmm. But yeah, every time I make that mistake, I make a stronger commitment to say I'm not going to impose unnecessary rules. And when I do have to have a rule, I'm going to explain why. So that instead of, you know, my kids following the rule because they want to get rewarded or they don't want to be punished, they'll follow the rule because they believe it's important. And then they're much more likely to think for themselves as opposed to just blindly conform to what, you know, what an adult might be telling them to do. And my hope is that at some point they will thank me for that.
To quote Dave Chappelle, does keeping it original ever, you know, or too original ever go wrong? Or are there ever, you know, originals that, or do we want everyone to be original? Do we want some non-original? You know, what's your...
Well, I think, Eric, every leader needs followers, right? And we can't all be nonconformists every moment in every situation. What I would say, though, is that the world doesn't suffer from, you know, the world doesn't suffer from too... Exactly. Too much creativity or too little conformity, right? I think we have too little creativity and too much conformity. And conformity is dangerous. Right? Conformity is a bunch of people saying, I don't think what you're doing is important or worthwhile, but I'm going to follow you anyway because I'm afraid of standing out and I'd rather fit in. And that weeds out diversity of thought. It kills innovation. And it sometimes can actually lead to serious, deadly kinds of consequences, right? When there's no minority to speak up and question the majority, that's when we start to see oppressive power take over. And, you know, I think that what I would like to see is a world where people think for themselves, right? Instead of conforming because they feel pressure to conform, they sit down, they think about other people's ideas, and they ask, is this a good idea? And if so, then they're willing to get on board with it and help to grow whatever, you know, that movement or principle is into something bigger.
What can we see as particularly encouraging to originals?
You know, it's funny. I asked Eric Weiner about this recently. So he wrote these two great books, The Geography of Bliss and The Geography of Genius. And the first book, it was the subtitle was something like One Grump's Search for the Happiest Place on Earth. And it was just this hilarious attempt to discover whether there was anywhere that was at all satisfied as somebody who himself was less so. And then in the newer book, he went around through history to try to figure out what were the most creative civilizations. And what do they have in common? What can we all learn from them? And as I was reading the second book, the question that stuck with me was, are there any places that are both creative and happy? So when I asked Eric the question, he said, well, you know, rarely do you even get one, let alone both. But he thought the best bet was Iceland, actually. If, you know, they consistently rank very highly in you know, international happiness comparison statistics. And it's also a place where you have a tremendous amount of originality from a very small population. And he said he thought one of the keys to their success on sort of being original and relatively content was one of their favorite sayings, which is, I'd rather go barefoot than without books. And, you know, I don't know if that actually makes sense from a survival standpoint, right? Like, books are not going to prevent your feet from getting frostbite unless you have a lot of survival guides with you. But I do think that, you know, that cultures that are highly original nurture people to read. And, you know, it's not just reading big ideas, it's reading fiction, right? We have actually a good body of evidence that reading fiction helps to build empathy. And it really gets you into the mind of a character who's different from you. It's the closest thing we have to actually living in somebody else's brain, which is the best way to broaden your own perspective. So I'm a huge fan of cultures that encourage reading early and often. And, you know, obviously not just reading the things that are assigned, but following your curiosity.
I'm curious to hear more about moments of non-originality and originality in your own life. And maybe we could start with the non-side. Maybe one example is the opportunity to invest in Warby Parker in 2009 when and you passed on it. Take us back to that moment and how you think about it, you know.
Thank you for reminding me. Yeah, so I was teaching my first class at Wharton in 2009. The student, Neil Blumenthal, comes to me and says, you know, I'm thinking about starting a company with three friends. We're going to sell glasses online. And I was wondering if you might be interested in investing. And I generally have not given money to students. Doesn't seem like a good idea. But as I learned more about the company, I got more and more dissuaded because they had not dropped out of school. Three of the four took internships over the summer just to make sure, you know, they had a backup plan. Then they all lined up full-time jobs for when they graduated, just in case it didn't work out. And the day before the company launched, they still did not have a functioning website. Like, you guys are an online company. You realize the entire business is a website? That's literally all it is. So I obviously did not invest. And they're now worth over $1 billion. They were just named the world's most innovative company by Fast Company. And this is why my wife is in charge of all of our investments now. But I learned a few things from that experience. One was that I should be really cautious about relying on my own intuition when I'm dealing with a domain that's foreign to me. So, you know, I looked at glasses online and I said, that's ridiculous, right? You have to go into a store and try them on. Never occurred to me, though, that I've never worn a pair of glasses in my life. So how would I know whether that's a viable idea or not? I am not your consumer. I'm in a bad position to judge. I should have actually sat down and analyzed the market, looked at how people make choices about whether to buy glasses or not. Is that something that they would do online? I would have concluded, yeah, Zappos did it for shoes. Could be done with glasses. I also, you know, I think that I made the mistake of thinking that because they were moving slowly and, you know, sort of covering their downside risk, that meant they weren't serious and committed. And I should have taken that instead as a signal that they were smart enough to know that starting a business is a low probability of success endeavor. And they do want to make sure that, you know, they haven't just destroyed their careers if this doesn't work out. And I've now taken that as, you know, much more of an indication that these are people who are careful and thoughtful, as opposed to they're not daredevils. Therefore, I should not invest in them.
What's another moment that comes to mind, or does a story of non-originality or originality?
Well, you know, when I think about my experiences with being unoriginal, one of the biggest moments that I guess was a turning point for me was I got to grad school. And after years and years of career indecision, I got inspired by a few extraordinary professors and said, I want to try to pay that forward. Lo and behold, I end up in this graduate school program, which was amazing, except that they told me I was not allowed to teach for my first 2 years. And, you know, the old me, I grew up as somebody who always respected my elders. I tried to follow every rule, even the ones that didn't make sense, even when no one was watching. Right, I was afraid of getting in trouble, and I remember crying once when I got called to the principal's office, even though I wasn't in trouble. Just like the idea of going to the principal's office was terrifying to me as a kid. And what ended up happening when I got to grad school was I was so passionate about teaching that I finally said, I'm going to have to, you know, buck the norms here and find a way to break this rule that I'm not supposed to teach until year three. So I went and found an advisor who was willing to sign off on some independent studies so I could bring some undergrads to work with me. And I went and interviewed a few dozen of them. I was supposed to take four, but there were 10 who were so impressive that I could not say no. And I ended up building a little research lab. And that lab ultimately became the group that I published my first major paper with. It's been running to this day. Now, I guess we're going on 13 years. And it's been one of the most meaningful things I've done professionally. And it was a great lesson to realize, look, it's not always bad to break a rule. In this case, you know, I actually, the presence of the rule led me to find a better way to get my ideas out there and a model that I could continue running even when I did start teaching regular classes. And it was a great lesson for me to question the status quo more often.
Of habits or principles that people can adopt in their own life to become more original.
I think my favorite one of all the recommendations that come out of the evidence is probably a simple one, which is to think of risk like a portfolio. It's really changed the way that I think about my own life. So, you know, I'm a really cautious, risk-averse person, and I thought that meant I couldn't do anything original. But then I read this work on risk portfolios that said, no, smart people just manage risk the same way they would do a stock market investment. So if you're going to bet on a very, very risky stock, you then should take a bunch of money and put it in a boring mutual fund, right? Where you know you're not going to lose it. And that's exactly what you see successful originals do with risk. They say, I'm going to be cautious, you know, in keeping a day job, in saving up money, in making sure in my regular job I built up some very conventional success so that when I do go out on a limb, I don't have anything to lose. And other people, you know, may listen or respect me more because I've done things that, you know, gained me status or that, you know, contributed a lot of value to others. And, you know, I guess for me, that's been really powerful, you know, just to sit down and say, you know, my version of this was I took, you know, a relatively linear path into, you know, a university where after I got tenure, then I said, look, you know, I no longer have to worry as much about the downsides of sharing ideas that other people might disagree with, because that's part of my job and you can't fire me. So here we are.
You know, differences or similarities with, in terms of the original with Malcolm Gladwell's concept of an outlier. You know, where does an outlier and an original differ?
So when I think of, it's interesting, Malcolm and I had a discussion about this last month at the 92nd Street Y, and we failed to even address that question at all. So I'm just going to imagine what he would say on this. I think he would say that his view of outliers is that they're people who, you know, achieve extraordinary success, but we underestimate the role of luck and opportunity and chance in their stories. And I think that most of us underestimate that in general, right? I think when we look at originals, where we see that play out is originals have more bad ideas than their peers. And that goes back to what we discussed a little bit earlier, that, you know, if you look at Picasso, over 20,000 pieces of art, how many of those are masterpieces? A much smaller fraction. Shakespeare wrote over 36 plays, right? And, you know, yes, we love Hamlet and Macbeth, but there are a few in there that critics have consistently panned. And I think that, you know, we overlook the fact that one of the best ways to become luckier is not just to put in 10,000 hours of deliberate practice or whatever number of hours is required for you in your field, but to say, I am going to churn out enough variety of ideas, a diverse enough pool of possible directions that I have a better shot at stumbling on something original. And luck is a huge part of that, but you can increase your luck by following the Thomas Jefferson mantra that, you know, I'm a great believer in luck and I find the harder I work, the more I have of it. I would edit that and say, I'm a great believer in luck and I find that the more ideas I produce, the more I have of it. And, you know, I think the biggest difference probably is that Malcolm, at least in Outliers, he takes a much more social structuralist view than I do. So he's interested in how the broader culture and society shapes our success. And I think that's a narrative that needed to be developed and fleshed out and reinforced for a lot of people. My view is much more psychological, driven by individuals and small groups, and I'm more interested in what all of us can do to increase our own originality. And I think that, you know, being original is a choice, right? We have decisions every day where we decide, am I going to follow the crowd or am I going to break from it? And I think we can develop habits that allow us to be more effective when we do make the non-conforming choice. And that's what I guess I'm trying to understand better.
When you wrote Give and Take a few years ago, you know, some people said you could have wrote a sequel to that. That could have been your life idea, the way Clayton Christensen, you know, Innovator's Dilemma, that could, over a lifetime that you continue to expand upon. What encouraged you to go in this direction? And did you think about that at the time? And
yeah, you know, this is interesting. We got a lot of requests for Give and Take sequels. And I just kept having this visceral reaction of, I don't believe in a nonfiction sequel. I think if you're going to sit down and write a book, you should say something original. And that means tackling not just some new ideas, but a whole new topic. Otherwise, you end up, you know, writing like the chicken soup for the dog's cat's soul. which at some point becomes derivative, even when maybe the first few were original. But I feel like, you know, going back to something we touched on earlier, I feel like original ideas come when you depart from your own assumptions. And so my first thought was, if I was going to write a sequel to Give and Take on topic, it would be called Take and Give, and it would be about why selfish jerks succeed. which, you know, would at minimum make sure that I was not typecast as the nice guy's finished first author. But Bob Sutton already wrote that book. It was amazing. It's called The No Asshole Rule. And, you know, I think we already understand, right, the conditions under which really selfish takers get ahead. So I didn't feel like that book needed to be written. I felt like it was also, you know, too close to what I had already explored before. So I took a step back and said, why do I feel that such a strong urge to say something that's new and different? And I realized it was because, you know, generosity is one of my core values in life, and that was what animated the first book. But originality is another one of those core values. And if this, you know, if this was so deeply ingrained that I was resisting what seems like, you know, a perfectly reasonable step to write a book that a lot of people are asking for, then this has got to be a topic that's worth exploring. And, you know, I've been doing research on how to champion new ideas and challenge the status quo since about 2004. So it seemed like it was a great topic to dive into further and try to bring, you know, a lot of the great ideas out there on this topic together. I wanted to write a book on dynamic duos. So I kept noticing over and over again that, yeah, I guess I was interested in the originality topic right off the bat. And these pairs kept jumping out at me that, you know, rarely were truly original people working solo or in triads or quads. It was often two people. You know, most basic unit of a relationship, we organize all of our romantic relationships that way in most of the Western world. You know, why don't we think about creativity the same way? And I had just started working on a proposal for that book when this book came out called The Powers of Two. Outstanding book by Joshua Wolfshank. Highly recommend it to anyone who hasn't read it. And I went through this book and read it and said, number one, he captured most of what I wanted to say. Number two, he covered even some of the same examples that I was planning to go through, like Lennon and McCartney and the South Park writers. And number three, he did it way better than I would have. It was masterful storytelling. There's some really surprising ideas in there, including that highly creative peers actually have, or pairs, excuse me, they have more conflict than less creative duos. And that's part of how they get to novel ideas. And I just walked away realizing this book has already been written. And, you know, I could have been really depressed by that. But then I started thinking about this research I had read on how quantity of ideas is the best way to get to quality of ideas. And then I thought, okay, I need to just generate more possibilities. And I'm going to write about that idea too, in what turned out to be original. So here we are.
Yeah, very meta. Do you have any hunches for what your, and I'm sure you have a ton of ideas, but any strong hunches for what your next book will be about? Obviously, you're focused on originals now, but...
I think it's too early to say at this point. I'm looking forward to having some time to think and step back a little bit. But I would say, you know, if somebody were to write not a sequel, but to really address the unanswered questions associated with this book, I would say there are two that keep coming up. One is, when you get rejected, how do you deal with that? You know, I think there are lots of examples of originals who persisted in the face of failure. And, you know, you can wonder, how many J.K. Rowling's never went to the 13th publisher after 12 turned down Harry Potter? And where do you get the courage and the will to keep going? How do you know whether it's even a good idea to keep going, right? There's a fine line between heroic persistence and escalation of commitment to a failing course of action. And I think we need more guidance about, you know, how to know when an idea is worth continuing to pursue and then how to find the motivation to do it. The other question that I feel really goes unanswered in originals is, how do you champion change from below? You know, if this is a question I get from my students a lot. If I'm not the boss and I have an idea for, you know, how to improve a practice that isn't working well, how to, you know, innovate in our industry, how to break a rule, how do I get heard? And how do I, you know, influence the organization when I'm not the person in power? Love to see somebody explore that in more depth.
Especially how do you know when to pursue the idea versus shut it down? I mean, for entrepreneurs, that's their lives, right? You know,
this is why I'm not an entrepreneur, right?
Yeah. Any hunches on how, you know, founders should think about that?
Well, I think, you know, my favorite insight on that comes from Barry Stott at Berkeley, who spent a lot of his career studying this problem of escalation of commitment to a losing course of action. And one of his best studies was of banks in California, where they have over and over again these problem loans, where you give a loan to somebody on their first mortgage and they default. And then you're like, wow, you know, this person's in a lot of debt. They're in a bad situation. Let me try to help them out. I'll give them a second loan. And then, you know, they can't pay that either. And pretty soon you just get into this trap where you're throwing good money after bad. And you should have just, you know, written off the first failed loan. So Barry wanted to know what predicts when a bank does that well. In other words, like they make the write-off decision early as opposed to, you know, continuing to put more and more and more money into a sinking proposition. And he found that bank turnover was one of the best things that you could have. That banks that had more turnover with senior managers actually had fewer problem loans. Why? The reason is that if you have no turnover in the bank, then the decision about whether to give loan number 4 is being made by the same people who approved loan number 1. And those are the worst people to make that decision, right? They're like, well, you know, I already made a bet on this person, and I want to prove to myself and everyone else who's watching that this was not a bad decision. So if I just give them a couple more loans, then, you know, this will, I'll be able to turn this thing around. And, you know, if there's turnover in the bank, new senior managers come in, they're like, this person has defaulted on 4 loans. This is not a smart financial decision. We need to write this off and cut our losses. And, you know, I'm not going to say that every startup should have massive turnover, right? Like, the lesson of this story is not kick your founder out on day 2, because, you know, otherwise you will never pivot. The lesson is that if you're the person who initiated an idea or a product or a direction, then you are not qualified to make the decision about whether to go forward with that idea, product, or direction, right? Because you're too positively biased. What you need is somebody neutral. You got to separate the initial decision maker from the later stage decision evaluator. And if you go to that person for advice or that group of people for advice, if they would say, look, I had no stake in the initiation of this idea, but I think it's a really powerful one, go forward. And you trust them and they're knowledgeable in the domain, then I think you keep going. And, you know, if you get more critical feedback, it's time to reconsider.
Can you describe for us the first 90 minutes?
I'll give you the part after like brushing teeth and kids going to school. You were asking about my workday, right? So the workday usually starts with me sitting at my computer and trying to write. Emphasis on trying, because some days writing is totally fluid. It's like having this conversation. Other days, there's the evil blinking cursor that just will not go away. And I think that writing, you know, I guess Aristotle was onto something when, you know, he described excellence as being much more of a habit than an act. You write every day, it's much easier to churn out words every day. And I tend to have, I guess, my freshest thoughts in the morning before I'm distracted by lots of different kinds of tasks, before I'm worried about my email inbox getting out of control. And when I've usually gone to bed thinking about an idea, and I, you know, sometimes will wake up with like a flash of a question or a curiosity. And so usually the first 90 minutes are trying to pursue that. And then, you know, the good news is when that first hour or 2 hours is over, I've given myself freedom to stop writing. And sometimes that means I will pause in mid-sentence and come back to something another day. In other cases, I'll say, you know what, this is really going well. I'm gonna keep going.
Writing is obviously especially writing a book, such a brutal, brutal task. How do you navigate any moments of self-doubt?
You know, it's funny because self-doubt is, I think it's a misnomer. You know, self-doubt is basically saying, you know, I shouldn't have sat down to do this to begin with. And anybody who writes or chooses any creative pursuit, there's a reason you sat down to do it. Either somebody at some point told you you had a talent or a knack for it, or you're just so interested in it, or you signed up for a job that requires enough of it that, you know, you're stuck doing it whether you're good at it or not. And so, you know, whether you're pushing yourself to do it, or you're feeling naturally pulled toward it, or somebody else is pushing you to do it, you're going to do it. I don't think it's worth asking, can I do it? The question to ask is, how can I do it better? A couple of weeks ago, Reid Hoffman, the LinkedIn founder, had a great answer to this sort of conundrum. I asked him how he thought about pushing forward, especially when, you know, some of his early ideas about social networks didn't take off. And he said, well, you know, I didn't have a lot of basis to be, you know, wildly self-confident, but I had confidence in myself as a learner. And he said, you know, I believe that, you know, because I'm curious, because I try to read widely and think deeply, that I can get more information, I can get better information, I can get better at a lot of different things. And so, you know, even if my work is really terrible today, I have confidence that I am going to improve about it tomorrow because I love to learn. And I think we should all have confidence in ourselves as learners. And, you know, if you don't, you would not be able to speak a language. You would not be able to do the job that requires creativity in the first place. And so I guess when I feel those moments of self-doubt, I have increasingly followed the kind of advice that Reid offers, which is, let me think back to the moments where, you know, I was really struggling with tasks in the past like this. And did I make it through them? And if I made it through those, then this one is probably not that different. As Elizabeth Gilbert puts it, frustration, you know, is not an interruption of the process. Frustration is the process. It's part of the process. It's an inevitable part of being creative.
You became the youngest tenured professor. When you reflect back on your success and, you know, written incredibly impactful books, what is a non-obvious principle? And you can't say luck, obviously, you know, a non-obvious principle that has led to your success. And another way of asking, what is your, you know, non-obvious core competence? Like, what are you
best? You gave me a little bit of an escape with that last phrasing, because I was going to say, I don't actually feel like I've been successful. There's always a gap between, you know, my aspirations and what I accomplish. And that's part of what motivates me to keep trying. But I think it's a terrible idea. If you ever meet someone who's truly successful, do not ever ask them what makes them successful, because they're the worst person to answer that question. They've never been able to look at themselves totally accurately in a mirror. It's often the people who know them well or who have collaborated with them that can see what makes them different from other people. And so I'm highly skeptical of people's own theories about what drives their success. However, you asked me what a core competence is that may be hidden. And that I think I can answer. I think that the thing that I have consistently found useful in my work is my memory. I grew up being made fun of by a lot of my friends when I was in elementary school. They called me Mr. Facts. And that was, you know, we were like collecting baseball cards. And we'd be in the middle of, you know, debating about whether a card was worth what the Beckett magazine says it was or not, which some people will remember fondly. And, you know, I would say, no, well, that's off because, you know, like Paul Molitor hit 287 last year. And that number was just there in my head. And I assume that everybody remembered those kinds of details well. And I later found out that was, you know, maybe something that was a little bit unique, not unique, but, you know, sort of useful in the way that my brain processed information is when I'm interested in something, it tends to stick. And that's helped with a lot of writer's block, because when I'm sitting in front of a computer not knowing what to say, I will just start to think, okay, what have other people said about this topic? And usually I have 20 or 30 sites or quotes that, you know, that are kind of waiting there. And then, you know, I kind of remember this is one of those moments, right? Like Carl Weick said, one of my favorite management scholars, he said that creativity is just putting old things in new combinations and new things in old combinations. And so sometimes I'll literally just sit there and say, let me pull out a bunch of insights about this problem from great thinkers. And let me see, where do they disagree? Where are they on the same page? And then in the process of trying to sort of stitch together that quilt, I'll have an insight.
Who comes to mind term success in the way that you want it for yourself?
Well, it's hard not to say J.K. Rowling. I think that, you know, I guess there are three things she's done that I really admire. One is that, you know, her books have reached more people than I think any book series in history, except maybe the Bible. So, you know, if reaching a lot of people is a meaningful way to have an impact, she's the pinnacle of that. Two, I think she's really planted the seeds for other people to be original, in that, you know, the protagonists in her stories are, you know, really innovative kids who step up and take responsibility for solving hard problems that adults don't even know how to tackle. And, you know, if you look at the data, children's stories are one of the best ways to stimulate the imagination and get kids to grow up and become more original themselves. And yeah, I think there's going to be a whole generation of Harry Potter inspired entrepreneurs, right? In the same way that like Star Trek led to a lot of the inventions that have happened in the last 20 or 30 years. And I think that's extraordinary. And then the last thing that she's done is there are some experiments showing that if you read Harry Potter as a kid, you become less prejudiced. You watch, you know, these wizards look down on muggles and you start to empathize and you don't want to treat outgroup members that way. And I think, you know, she's reached a lot of people. She's encouraged them to innovate, and she's also encouraged them to be more moral and caring toward people who are different from them. That's a pretty meaningful impact, if you ask me.
And we'll close with this. You know, you mentioned Outliers has this more social structuralist view on, you know, what leads to a person's success, while Originals more of an agency, you know, focus on the individual, which I appreciate. What do you say to the person who doesn't identify as original, though, or doesn't even identify and think that they have agency? Maybe they didn't grow up in a circumstance that led them to to believe that? How can they, you know, sort of overcome that obstacle in cultivating a sense of agency and originality? Mm-hmm.
The first thing I would say to that person is that that belief is a self-fulfilling prophecy. But if you believe you have no agency, no choice, no control, then that's going to be guaranteed to be true. Right. Whereas if you say maybe there's a small choice that I can make that would, you know, that would alter how, you know, even just a tiny part of my job is experienced, then you know, you start to realize that we can all make changes to the world around us on the margin. Some of them are going to be small, but if you can accumulate enough small wins, then either other people will start to take you seriously, or you're in a better position then to, you know, figure out what's working and what isn't, and where you should invest your creative impulses. And, you know, I guess the starting point for that person then would be to say, what's the last time you really fundamentally disagreed with something that was happening around you? And let's then figure out, have you ever seen someone try to change that? If they succeeded, what did they do well and what can you learn from that? If they failed, where did they go wrong and how can you succeed in their place? And I think we can all have a bigger impact that way.
And any last minute plugs where people can find you online or, you know, learn more about it and you?
If you have nothing better to do, if you go to adamgrant.net, there's a little quiz about whether you know what it takes to be original. And I think on average, about people are getting about 6 out of 16 questions right, which has been a fun start.
Perfect. Perfect. Thank you, Adam. Have a great rest of your day. And we will chat soon. The book is Originals. Check it out.
Thank you.